You are listening to Fika with Vicky on United Public Radio, 107.7 and 105.3 from New Orleans.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fika. Today, we're welcoming back author Robin Hearn. Robin's a druid, storyteller, poet, lecturer, and for some of us, most importantly of all, a dog owner. His writing style pulls me in and has me laughing, gasping at the audacity, and learning all at the same time. On Robin's last visit, we focused on his works, The Magic of Wolves and Bard's Song. This week, we'll be looking at Pythion, the Egyptians, and A Dangerous Place, a crime anthology. Considering the TARDIS references in his work, I feel safe in referring to Robin as the Doctor, taking us to past worlds and other worlds, back to the now, and even thinking about the future, all seamlessly. Thanks for the travels, Robin, and welcome to Fika.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
A pleasure. Definite pleasure. Now, the two books we're going to be looking at, The Pantheon, The Egyptians, and A Dangerous Time, are really very different books in the scheme of things. So we're going to start with A Dangerous Time. That's the crime fiction anthology. And it really has a very different premise, a twist, if you will. Do you want to talk about what gave you such a unique idea?
Certainly. It's an anthology of short stories. All of them are crime-related stories. All set in the same place, but at different periods in history. So it stretches from the ancient Druids and the Iron Age tribes all the way through to the 21st century. It doesn't go in a mathematical leaping order. So it's not a precise period of time between each story. They just kind of randomly jump forward in time. And the working idea behind it was born out of a number of conversations with various different friends over the course of many years about the notion of the what the Romans used to call the genius loci, that we tend to refer to these days as the genius loci. Pronunciation changes over time. The spirit of place. So there is this notion in very early Roman religion of the noumena, where we get the word numinous from, that the noumena is a nameless presence. You enter a place, and possibly you might have places that leap immediately to your own mind of where you've had this kind of an experience, where you go somewhere and there's just something about it that is beautiful and mysterious and wonderful, and the hairs on the back of your neck go up and you are convinced that there is someone or something there, something watching you. Now, that can be in a very benevolent, kindly, welcoming way. But there's also the possibility, of course, that the genius loci may be very hostile and unwelcoming, and people have that sort of almost like a haunted house experience where they go to a place and feel there's something malevolent watching them.
Ooh, you get that chill down your back.
Exactly. Now, there's a debate to be had in terms of the sort of philosophy and ethics behind it. Is the malevolent presence genuinely malevolent, or does it just not like you personally? Now, just because somebody doesn't like me doesn't necessitate that they're a monster. They may have good reasons for not liking me. So equally, a spirit of a place may take against me without in and of itself being a terribly wicked being. But of course, as humans, we're not prey species as such, but we are in that ambiguous position of being both predator and prey. Not so much these days, of course, given that we've slaughtered just about every rival predator on the planet. But going back into earlier periods of history, we had to be careful what was creeping up behind us, because I'm told we are quite tasty.
Only told, Rob and I, yes.
Just in case there's any police officers listening, definitely. It's understandable that if we feel something to be hostile, we tend to react to it as a malevolent force. Now, for the purposes of this book, there is a decidedly malevolent force. It's not simply a reaction. It genuinely is quite nasty. And it influences people from generation to generation. I was quite taken with a story by a North American author, Shirley Jackson. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She used to write a lot of ghost stories, became quite famous. One of which is the Haunting of Hill House, which is
a classic.
Absolutely. And again, that's an intergenerational haunting of the same property as experienced by a number of different people owning the property over time, which is, for me, it's an interesting, because obviously a lot of ghost stories, it's a family, like the Amityville, you know, a family in the house, you find out about them, the story ends, job done. The notion of the same entity coming back again and again and again over the course of a period of time is a more challenging idea. And so I wanted to explore the notion that just as if you live in a very happy place for a long period of time, it's likely to lift your spirits. Even if you're miserable when you arrive, the fact that you're in this therapeutic environment will render you into a better state of mind. So likewise, if you were a very happy person, but you moved somewhere that had a malevolent presence, and maybe you lacked the options to go away and move somewhere else, so you kind of had to stay there.
Well, you get that even in like a regular house or whatever. There are just some places you don't want to be, yes, and they do bring you down.
Oh, absolutely. So it's working on the idea that that presence would have an effect on the people there. It would warp them. It would bring out the very worst in them. And so,
and it does.
It does indeed. People turn to murder. They turn to all manner of other rather antisocial activities and crimes. And there's an element of Agatha Christie. I'm a great admirer of Agatha Christie. So all of the murders are resolved somehow, if not by judicial procedure, then by other procedures. So the villains are always caught. But you could argue the underlying villain, that spiritual
never
presence,
gets caught because they're always there.
Yes.
And you even do that thing that I absolutely don't like, is that you mix children with axes. But still, I remained because the story is so good. It pulls you in so well that, let me explain. You go from the ancient Druid time,
yeah,
up. You tried different ways of doing all the different stories. One's in first person, one's in, you know, then there's like you experimented with a lot of different styles. And that is interesting, on top of the fact that the way the characters speak also naturally change with the times as well. You can feel all of that within the book. So bravo. I love this, and it needs to get out there. It needs to get out there more. Now, behind each of these stories, which cover a lot of different folklore and tales, and it's almost like a monster of the week, but it's a monster of the chapter. I'm thinking series here, Robin. I really enjoyed this. So you have all of this information, and at the end of each chapter, you tell us what you base that on, the true story behind, or the urban legend, or whatever it happens to be, yeah, behind the story that you wrote. Now, you've talked about ethics and storytelling on our last episode. Do you think this is important to do? So people, is that part of your ethics, to let them know where you got the story from, or just interest?
Oh, absolutely. It is part of the procedure. For me, it was an interesting thing to research, trying to link in a different form of folklore to each story and different understandings. And even though it's all in the same place, and Suffolk, for those listeners who are unfamiliar with Suffolk, is, or has been for most of its history, a very, very rural county, a little bit of a backwater. It's good few miles from London, but it was a port area, and part of it is coastal, and certainly Ipswich, the town where I live, was a port area, so there was a lot of trading coming in from the continent. So even though it was rural, it still had an influence from other places, both the big cities like London, but also influences. So people were aware of other individuals from other parts of the world, different cultures coming in, the Vikings, the Romans, the Angles, the Saxons, different waves of people coming in over a period of time and bringing different cultures with them. So there's an element of that reflected in the different stories. That one of the stories is upon Egyptian mythology, because there's obviously the Roman Empire, as it expanded, drew in influences from other cultures and shifted them around the empire. So where St. Paul's Cathedral is now in London, there was once a temple to the goddess Isis. So it kind of gives you a flavour of how multicultural things have been at different points in time. Never quite to the level of multiculturalism that we have in the 21st century, obviously, because the
but
numbers
more than
of
most people
were significantly smaller.
But most people don't think of people moving around during those times as much. But they did. They got around.
Oh, absolutely. I've tried to bring elements of that in. There's a story involving Jewish folklore and the golem and the clash with Catholic views of the Jewish community and all sorts of different understandings and ideas and folk traditions coming in. And I thought it would be interesting for readers to understand some of the mechanics, because obviously a reader might be quite familiar with one type of culture, but totally unfamiliar with another. And part of understanding the story and getting what's going on involves understanding some of the culture, the traditions, why people do what they do, why they believe what they believe, and how beliefs lead to actions, sometimes very good actions, sometimes very immoral actions. So the kind of section at the end of each story giving the backdrop to either the folk tales or to the historical detail, like the story of Mother Lakeland, who was a real woman who was tried and executed for witchcraft. So giving her a backstory, I thought it was quite useful for people to know not only the fictionalized version, but also the actual historical details. And that might inspire, for those who are unfamiliar, might inspire them to go and dig deeper.
No doubt the notes were as interesting. Not that your stories were. The notes were equally interesting. And I think it reflects on, we can look at that and see how a lot of those things are happening even today. Like when you see the process and bringing the human element of the story, which you do very well. We're going to bring that up in Egyptians. But I just think it can make you think about how those things are happening even now under different names, different processes. But humans be humans. They
absolutely. And persecution still goes on, not in quite the same way, but it still goes on.
Yeah. And they can't get away with as much in certain areas, but it's still there, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Good afternoon, Brian. Hi, Robin. Not everyone can sense spirits. Are some people spirit blind just as some people are color blind? Are spirit blind folks immune to the influence of spirits, do you think?
I publish a couple of newsletters for different organizations. And inevitably, as anyone who's published a newsletter knows, you end up having to write half the damn thing yourself. So for copy to come in, you thought, oh, sod it, I'll just write a column myself. One of the columns, like a mini filler for one of those awkward spaces where you...
Yes.
Look at it, is like a word of the week kind of thing. And it's usually a made-up word that's got some funny esoteric spin on it. And donkeys years ago, I came up with a word for one of the newsletters of silent, but spelled P-S-I, silent. P-S-Y-L-E-N-T. And to argue, just as exactly your contributor, just listener rather, just contributed that, just as some people are born blind or born deaf or born without a sense of smell or whatever, that there are some people, I would argue, are born without that, what should we call it, sixth sense, paranormal sense, whatever you want to describe it as being. So just as one person perhaps can't tell the difference between red and brown, somebody else might not be able to tell the difference between a hostile presence and a benevolent presence, or any presence whatsoever. And you could argue that maybe some of those people do remarkably well in some areas of life, where a lack of ability to detect certain things is no harm or hindrance. And maybe there are more people who are silent than the opposite, than sensitive. And that's led to the sense that the world, for a lot of people, it's particularly with the rise of the mechanistic view of the universe during the 17th, 18th century, that increasing numbers of people feel that there is nothing there. It's a little bit like, Jesper Ford, who is, I think he's British, if I remember rightly, he's a British author. He writes a lot of fantasy fiction set in sort of alternate universes and so on. And he's got one. I was given a copy of his most recent book as a birthday present. I haven't had a chance to start it yet. But in this world, most people are colorblind. And people can, by various methods, learn to see certain colors. But there's the whole kind of hierarchy as to who can see what. And suspicion of people who claim to be able to see something they shouldn't be able to see. And it's led to all kinds of weird divisions within this society based upon what people can or cannot see in terms of different shades of colour. And to an extent, you could argue that perhaps, maybe going back into a distant past, people who were sensitive to things were, you know, the shamans, the witches, the druids, the Gothi, whatever, the wise men and women of the village. And the ability to have those experiences might have been a fairly aspirational thing for a lot of people, something to be looked up to. Whereas,
I think it probably still is for a lot of people, not all people, but for a lot of people. They still want to know that what they experience is, you know what, it's a sense of knowing that gives you, like, you know what you know, Robin. And yes, that is something to be aspired to have that confidence to know, which probably took you some time to achieve, I would think. But I think that's what people would like, is that confidence.
Well, yes, and it comes with time. It's a little bit, I'd love a glass of wine as much as the next drunk. But
see, I don't laugh at some of his insights, but this is why I love his writing. It's just like it comes along and then there it is. Okay, go ahead, Robin.
I'd love to pretend to be a wine connoisseur. I'm just a lush, you know. I can't tell the difference between a Shiraz and a Chardonnay. I just like to drink them. Obviously, there are some people who can take a sip and tell you which year, which grape vineyard, and you know which wine producing house created it and everything else. Is their tongue somehow mutated and different from my tongue? No, they've just learned to train, whereas I haven't. I've just learned to chuck it back and fall over. They've learned to develop sensitivity of palate, which I suppose if I were that keen, I could go along to some wine tasting course and learn how to do it as well.
But you spent your time developing other sensitivities.
Indeed. Let's go with that.
There we go. Okay, so you're talking now, and there's all this information in your books, and I need to know how you keep it all straight. Like, do you have a million journals where you've written this down? Do you just have this immense memory? Is it that you've worked with it so much it's just a second part of your being? Or how does Robin keep track of all this?
It sinks in fairly quickly. There's lots of things I forget, and it takes me a while to track stuff down. I could pretend to be a bit like, if you've ever seen the relatively recent version of Sherlock with Benedict Cumberbatch, where he claims to have a mind palace. I've got a mind attic. It's just full of crap everywhere, and cobwebs. And it takes a while to rake through the boxes and find what I'm looking for, but it's in there somewhere. So I tend to be fairly good at retaining most information. But I don't have mountains of notebooks or anything like that, unfortunately. I do try notebooking with plots, and then I usually lose the notebooks and have to start all over again from memory. So I may be able to remember the ideas even if I can't remember where I left the notebook or the pen.
Yeah, so once again, you're choosing to focus on other things than pens and where the notebook is. And have you ever considered going on a trivia game?
I'd be hopeless if sport or pop music came up. My musical taste ended in about 1935, so I don't keep abreast of much modern music. Sport in one brain, so then out the other.
So it has to be a trivia game with specific topics, and then you'll do just fine. Okay. Now, is it okay if we talk about the idea that you might be working in another crime fiction?
Yep, yeah, sure. Yep. Yeah.
That you would like to? Okay, so I'm very excited to announce that Robin says he would really like to write another crime novel.
Indeed. I've got one I've been working on, off and on for some years, whilst also writing other books. So it's kind of dragging out a bit in terms of actual completion. But it does involve one of the characters that was introduced in the anthology, who I quite liked writing. I've had to revise some of the things that I said about the character in the short story for long fiction form to make it a bit more manageable. But it is about 95% the same as the character in the short story, which is a figure based on a real life person called Old Winter, who is the was back in the 1700s, the cunning man of Ipswich. Now, there's a few references to him in books from the 18th century, 19th century, talking about various supposed things that he did to find people who'd stolen firewood or stolen bundles of wool and got up to no good, or cursed somebody's cattle and all that kind of thing. So little anecdotal bits. So I've pieced together a character for him. And it, as some of the notes say in the anthology, I work best when I'm writing fiction if I can visualize what somebody looks like.
Right.
So try and come up with a face, which could be just some random person I saw on a bus once. I think, oh, your face will do. And I just kind of acquire that, or it could be a celebrity or, you know, a friend, next door neighbor, somebody like that. In this particular case, there was a British actor who's been dead some years now, unfortunately, called Geoffrey Belden. If any of your listeners are fans of Wurzel Gummidge from the 1970s, he played the Crow Man in Wurzel Gummidge. He also appeared in a series called Catweasel as this time-travelling wizard. And a very, very gaunt man, a character actor. He was never what you'd call massively famous. He wasn't a kind of Hollywood A-lister.
But he
was well known on British television. One of those character actors that you always see in different shows. Sadly, usually in relatively small parts rather than in leading roles, but you know, in lots of different things. But he, in both the Catweasel one and the Wurzel Gummidge one, he plays these sort of wizard characters. And so he leapt immediately to mind for what would the Wizard of Ipswich, which Old Winter was referred to as the Wizard of Ipswich, what would he look like? So that actor's image came to mind.
In your head.
I visualize him when I'm writing. And so this is an expanded version. Now, I'm hoping if this proves reasonably popular that it might lead to, you know, a second, a third, a fourth.
A series.
Indeed.
Well, I'm looking at, because I quite liked Mr. Winter and his story in the anthology. I thought I will be happy to hear more about him. And I will encourage other people to be happy as well to hear more about Mr. Winter, because, yeah, I like him. So thank you. Thank you for sharing that with us. And I'm happy to know that. So we'll move on to. We'll come back. We're all over the place, just like your stories. But we'll move on to the Egyptians now. And we have a question right off the bat. I knew he was going to ask something like this. But Dave, who is supposed to be paying attention to my bread in the oven, would like to know, what would ancient Druids think of an event like the eclipse? I know you're not an ancient Druid. Okay. I thought you wanted to know the Egyptians thought about. Okay, event like the eclipse on the 8th, along with the planets aligning in a comet all at the same time. How would they react to something like that?
Well, we know the Druids used to study, there's references to them studying the stars as well as studying patterns of clouds and bird flights and things like that. So looking upwards for revelation from the gods. We don't know precisely what they believed about astrology, even though there's a few books around on Celtic astrology, but they're all kind of modern day interpolation rather than reliable ancient data. I suspect they would have looked to either some major, for them, upheaval event, a great battle or something of that sort, or quite possibly a birth, a significant birth, that maybe some future chieftain, some great leader or archdruid or whatever they might be, would be born at the time of the planetary conjunctions and passing and so on.
So it'd be like, get out the prophecies and let's see which one fits, right? and how do you think the ancient Egyptians would react? Probably the same type of way, or?
Much the same. They'd be looking for some seriously significant event to start happening in the world. I mean, there's been lots of interesting astronomical events where nothing obvious has happened in the world. But that's because we kind of have too much of a Hollywood expectation of grandiose cataclysms.
I was thinking that today. I was thinking this morning, there is like, you know, even with this happening, there are a lot of speculations of what it means and how it relates to prophecies of various different religions and spiritualities. And I thought, you know, I personally wouldn't want to go out there saying that because people have been proven wrong so many times. But then I thought, well, maybe it's more of a, you know, metaphorical kind of thing. I should look back and see, you know, what, like subtle things might have changed. And then I thought, no, that's too much work. But yes, there's always somebody thinking this means something, right?
Oh, absolutely. It does remind me a little bit of the Jehovah's Witnesses who had the great disappointment. They've actually had several great disappointments. Going back to the 19th century, one of their leaders, based upon his interpretation of the Bible, predicted the Day of Judgment taking place in the 1800s. And so many people within the Jehovah's Witness movement believed it that they sold off their houses and their furniture, and they kind of gave the money to the poor and did all the worthy things and went and sat on the hillside waiting for the hand of God to come on down and take them up to paradise and leave the wicked to, well, suffer. And you know, obviously, still waiting.
And waiting and without, you know, a residence to return to. Yes. I think it's always good to keep one foot on the earth. And yeah. In reality is good. So there we go, talking about personal spirit experiences in the pantheon, the Egyptians. You talk about the UPG, or unsubstantiated personal gnosis, which is like, you know, the actual facts of the religion or the faith. And then there is the personal experiences. Now, I like in your book, how both are laid out, because I get to see what they did and how people have related that to modern times. Do you think one is more important than the other, or a basic balance is important?
For me, the verifiable historical details have to come first.
Right.
That can quite often back up the UPG. And I have known cases where several people independently of each other have had a similar flash of insight. And then something archaeological has come to light, which then backs up that shared flash of insight into a particular idea, concept, practice, whatever. So in a sense, potentially two sides of the same coin. Of course, the danger or risk, or whatever you want to call it, is that it can be difficult to tell the difference between wishful thinking and personal gnosis. when is my desire for something to be true so strong that I kid myself into thinking I've had a visionary flash from the great beyond, when in fact I'm just daydreaming and wishing a thing to be true? So it, again, a little bit like that wine taster's palate. I think that's something you learn by trial and error and making a few silly mistakes and eventually learning to sense the difference between desperate fantasy and a genuine spiritual vision, a visionary flash of understanding.
To be honest to oneself is difficult sometimes, but we have to do that, right? That's part of the process.
Yes.
And well, and as well, in today's day and age, I think it's important to know the facts for yourself, to research these things behind these beliefs because of marketing, okay? I hate to be the cynic, but people like to use anything to sell things, right? So they'll tell you this means that, and this means that. And there's all kinds of, we can't even keep straight the details of what is happening on Earth now in everyday lives and politics. You know, it is good to have something that we can go back and historically hold on to.
Absolutely, right? Yes. It grounds us. Where there is a room for debate is when we apply things to modern practice, knowing what people did 3,000 years ago and knowing with solidity what they did 3,000 years ago does not necessitate us having to replicate it now. Now, there's a difference between an author saying 3,000 years ago they did X, and they've just made it up out of thin air, but they're presenting it as if it were true. And somebody else saying, in the modern world, I would like to do X because I think it would please this goddess, that god, whoever, which is not making a historical claim of continuity, but saying, I feel this would be appropriate. Now that's...
Yeah, no, because we're all different people with different experiences, different needs. And so we're going to use our experiences to see whatever that entity, deity, whatever means to us. Absolutely. So I think, I mean, the entire thing, you can stop and say, Vicky, you're off your rocker anytime you want. I'm just thinking out here, but the entire point of story in one way is to change, as you know, the storyteller would change depending on the village or what the year was, lucky for the hunt or not lucky for the hunt. Stories change with the experiences of the time. So you're going to want to up it a little bit for the modern times and how you would relate, sort of like in Neil Gaiman's he modernized Yeah, I should know that right off that it went to the attic there. But sort of like he did in that book, right? We know that's not the way they were originally, but he took that liberty to bring them to us now. So there's going to be some different types of rituals in that because of the times.
Absolutely. And of course, some things, even if certain gods or goddesses do want them done old style, are now illegal. Or next to impossible to get them to.
just with druids themselves. You've got to do what you've got to do to get some quiet alone time. go ahead.
Well, I'd say it is a challenge, and certainly adapting things. The Pantheon book is, although there's a lot of history in it, it's not per se a history book, in that it's not just saying this is the way the world was 3,000 years ago. It's rather saying this is the way it was and this is how it can influence us today. So there is that sort of practice element.
That's what I like about it. And it's like, and your crypts, which I'm okay. So I love your nonfiction writing style because I learn things, but you have this way of shoving in, you know, you make us feel like you're talking to us, like you are right now. It's just natural. You'll be talking away and all of a sudden there will be this opinion that's like but I can't believe you just said that. No, he's not that bad. So it's usually, you know, or a pop reference or whatever. It's just like you're talking out the book. Now, is that something you've honed? With your lecturing in that you're used to keeping an audience entertained?
Well, that's the way I write is pretty much the way I teach. So it's, I do occasionally video seminars and public lectures and things like that. And certainly a lot of people say there is a lot of similarity where they've been to, you know, both read a book and been to a lecture and say, well, kind of, it's a very similar sort of an experience. I like to chuck in various, as close to pop references as I get. I'm a bit out of touch with a lot of things these days. So particularly when I'm talking to sort of teenagers or people in their early 20s, clearly a lot of it is going over their heads. For what I consider a pop reference, they consider an antique.
Yes, I know that feeling, Rob.
It's a solitary experience. You realize how dated you are.
But luckily, if people follow certain genres, then they're going to keep up just with that legacy idea. So, for example, Doctor Who or Sherlock Holmes, or, you know, some of us have been lucky enough to experience like Jeremy Brett and Mr. Cumberbatch, Benedict. You can relate to them on that, on a legacy level, most definitely. But most importantly, this helps you to keep track of who's actually awake and listening, because I know I stay alert on those pages so I don't miss any of these little treasures that are Robin's. So it is, people, if you're looking to learn something, Robin just has an excellent way about his writing that keeps you involved. Thank always you. Robin. I sort of used that. So in the book, and this is a thing, because I think this is how I learn, so I want to know if I'm weird or not. Okay, I know I am, but in this specific thing, you talk about, I'm going to get this out wrong, the Heliopolitan?
Oh, yes, the Heliopolitan myth, yes.
Yes, okay, I did it right. And so there is the myth, and you say this is the myth, that's what happened. But then you talk about how you tell it to keep people involved. And it begins with, in the beginning was none, an endless formless sea of chaos full of unmanifested potential. And see, now this pulls me in and I want to know more about this. Or it could just be how I feel when I wake up in the morning. But then there was today. It is so much more intense and engaging.
It's a fascinating story. There are, it's worth pointing out, quite a number of Egyptian creation myths, of which this is one of the more perverse ones, which is, of course, why I tell it, because it's got the slightly prurient shock factor of how the world is brought into existence by a very bored and lonely deity. For the Egyptians, that's not a problem, which I think is always worth emphasizing. Whatever the religious backgrounds of the various people listening to this are, pretty much all of them, I guess, will have been brought up in a mostly monotheist culture. Whether they practice themselves or not is another issue, but they will have been familiarized with
notions. In the beginning, that's what they were.
And certainly within monotheism, not only do you have the idea of one God, but you have the idea of one truth. There is a story, a definitive version of the story. And if anyone comes along and tries to change it, vary it, spin it, then at best they're being a bit naughty. At worst, they are engaging in outright blasphemy by introducing alternate versions.
Right, now, right.
For the Egyptian culture, and if we get the time, we could get sidetracked into discussions of quite what theology predominated in ancient Egypt, because there are different takes according to who's writing an account of it. So as a polytheist, I view it as a polytheist culture. There are modern-day Muslim historians, Egyptologists, who regard ancient Egypt as a monotheist culture, much like Islam. So we have a tendency to project our own ologies back onto a distant peoples who are no longer in a position to agree or disagree. But part of the nature of polytheism is that it's open to pluralism, multitudes of ideas. So there is not one single creation story. There are multiple creation stories. Did people in ancient Egypt bash the hell out of each other in arguments as to whose creation story was the best? I very much doubt it. I mean, they may have privately thought that tribe up the road, their story is a bit boring or something like that, but they weren't about to go and set light to one another.
You talk about the neighbors at the dinner table. Well, you're going to talk about their creation story just the same. And I think in general, they were any of the cultures with multiple gods, goddesses, were more open to others. I mean, when you look at them, because they had many. So what's one more to the table?
Fundamentally, they regarded historically the stories as mainly metaphorical. Mm-hmm. The notion, for example, obviously in North America, as in the Middle East, biblical literalism or Quranic literalism in the Middle East is a very widespread phenomenon. The notion that if the Bible says 7 days of creation, it was 7 days, not six, not eight, seven. You can get into debates as to how long a day was. It was a day 24 hours or 24
minutes. But you don't mess with the seven.
Exactly. Were the ancient Egyptians literalists in that sense? I suspect not. I suspect they understood that there were half a dozen different creation myths because they're all different ways of poetically describing something that's actually way beyond most people's capacity to understand. So one of I don't go into this one very much in the book, but one of the other creation myths is about the universe hatching from a gargantuan goose egg and the story of the great cackler, as it's referred to, this cosmic goose. Did people back then think there was a million foot tall goose laying an egg the size of a mountain and the universe emerging from it? Well, probably not. I suppose there might have been somebody somewhere who took it fairly literally, but I'd guess most people saw it as a metaphor.
Which, but yes, that as soon as people take it seriously and then there's only one way, you run into problems.
Yes.
You should run away and I'll let them believe what they want to about their goose egg, right? And what it all started. But it does. So you say that they take it metaphorically because, and as an educator, I'm asking you, I think that myself, I want to learn all the names of the trees and the things, but I'm never going to do it in a scientific way. But darn it, you give me... You give me a sacred grove and all the trees, and I'm out there identifying them and learning the stories behind them and what they're supposed to. Do you think story is a way of getting people to be more enthusiastic about learning?
Oh, absolutely. There's, I think he's still alive, a chap called Kieran Egan, who Irish-born but has lived much of his life in North America. And he writes teacher training books on the nature of education. And one of his kind of big arguments in the various books he writes is that humans are quintessentially storytelling animals. Going back to ancient times, sitting around the campfire, telling each other a story about how the hunt went today, or when Granny was off in the woods gathering berries and what she saw and what went on, and everything becomes a story. And it's passed down generation to generation. His argument is that in modern day styles of education, there's been too much reliance on repetition of facts.
Rote
learning, going back to the days of a Dickensian character called Gradgrind, who used to kind of beat information into the kids in the school, and they had to repeat everything he said, and it was all very kind of monotonous. That's been very, very common and widespread in the past. He says, instead of, let's say it's a history class, and you want to teach kids about the kings and queens and the pharaohs of Egypt, so we'll stick with the theme, you're trying to get them to that, you could put a big long list up on the wall. This pharaoh, here are the dates, and you just get the kids to memorize them. Then they shout loud at them, eventually they will. Have they learned anything? Well, they learned a load of names, but they don't necessarily have any meaning or context to those names. They're just parroting words. His argument is, if you tell them the story, this is what this king did, that happened, this king was murdered, oh, that king ran off and got killed in a battle, and no, you bring it to life. You make a kind of a drama, a soap opera. Mm-hmm. You make myth out of it. And just as there are, and I know people who claim to have no memory for anything, but they can tell you the plot of their favourite soap opera going back for the last 1,000 episodes of who shagged who and who murdered who and all of that rubbish. They have a phenomenal memory for story, if the story grabs them. If maths, English, geography, chemistry were presented in a way that grabbed them, they'd have a phenomenal memory for that as well. Trouble is, it's not presented in a way, or at least not when they were young, that grabbed them. So they're at a bit of an educational disadvantage on that one. Now, he makes an argument which I 99% agree with, that almost every subject can be turned into a story. There are certain subjects where I'm not sure how, to be honest, and things like maths, having taught maths in the past, I can see some elements, but I struggle to think.
Yeah, they're
get that as a story, but yeah, that's a small point.
So it's best just to ignore them. I'm not telling people to just to ignore math. It just slipped out.
The pyramids got built. But it's bringing out the human drama and fundamentally mythology, whether it's about kings or gods or dragons or whatever it is. There's always a human drama to it, even if the beings in the story aren't actually human
that
beings.
You can relate to if having a similar, like in a metaphorical way. Okay, Robin, I was wondering where you were. Robin is very busy at work right now, but has time to write this message, but I'm all ears. Robin, have you ever come across in your research anything about the Tartarian race?
As in the Tartars of the Russian steppes, or is...
Probably... I thought he means, but you so are. Robin, we're on hold until you get back to us. Drop the work and give us more information on the question. I think story is, I mean, in one way, we're in a renaissance of stories. We can stream anything we want to at any time. Every book, we can either, you know, download it from the library in seconds or whatever. But on the other hand, personal stories seem to be getting shoved to the side a little bit, do you think?
Oh, undoubtedly, yes. We're not terribly, this is a problem I've had myself. Donkeys years ago, I was invited to attend a ritual, part of which was people were requested to share a personal story from their own life, an autobiographical story. And I can reel off several hundred myths and legends at the drop of a hat, but it was a real struggle, painful, like pulling teeth, to try and get anything that had happened to me that I thought was remotely interesting enough to turn into a story. So that's me in therapy for the next 20 years. It's a challenge to understand ourselves as stories. And it's a fundamental point within narrative psychology. that we not only, as Kieran Egan says, learn chemistry and history and geography and what have you through storytelling, but we learn ourselves through storytelling. You stood next to somebody at the bus stop or a train station, you share an anecdote, all this happened when I went shopping last week. I mean, it's not your whole life history, it's a 30-second anecdote, but it's a story. If, that is to say, you will share it if you think the other person is interested. Or you're so bloody minded you don't care if the other person is interested.
Your lacking of self-awareness allows you to be open at all times. But do you think that kind of has something to do with it? Some people, whether sensitive or whatever, do not feel that they are interesting.
Yes.
Enough. That they're bragging or they're taking up people's time.
It's that's perhaps quite a sort of a British thing, the discouragement of boasting and bragging, which, without wanting to cast aspersions upon other cultures, there are other parts of the world where it's almost de rigueur that you kind of, you know, put yourself forward and you use.
Well, and if you don't, you're considered weak.
Well, exactly.
So I live on the border between Canada and. No, but it gets things done. On the other hand, they get things done.
Absolutely.
People who can go out there and say, this is my need, this is, know themselves and their own story enough that this is important, get things done.
Yes. Absolutely.
And they're not always conveniently around for quieter folks to use. I've been known to whisper in an ear and say, I need this. That is the thing. So yes, get out there and tell more stories, I think.
Indeed. And perhaps encouraging kids from a young age to, there is a fine line between having a kid who is so forthright that they bore everyone to death by going on and on and on about themselves, and having a kid who is at least confident enough to put themselves forward. And part of that confidence is feeling that there is an audience willing to listen.
That they are important enough for that story. It's a fine line with anything when it comes to kids. Like, you want them to be confident, but you don't want them to, you know, I feel sorry for the parents of any world leaders, okay?
Yes.
Raising them.
Narcissism in the world is
yes, exactly. Okay. Now we're going to get, David, why did you bring this up? We only have 7 minutes late. Mr. Bennison would like to know, what does Robin think of the Egyptian culture being influenced by an alien contact? It's become the subject of so many stories and film, but I always honestly think is a bit far-fetched in my opinion. Your opinion is usually much stronger than that, David.
Already mentioned, as a fan of classic Doctor Who growing up, I'm not particularly interested in the modern version. I must have gone off it a bit, but the old school style of Doctor Who, I'm still an enormous fan of. I suppose that doesn't necessitate believing in real aliens, but actually I do. I'm absolutely convinced the cosmos, the size that it is, it's just mathematically ridiculous to think that humans are the only species, and there's got to be other things out there, both very, very advanced things and very basic life forms as well around the cosmos. Why they would want to come here is an entirely other question. And that, I suspect, going to Dave's point, a lot of it has roots in that sort of Eric von Daniken approach to suggest that vastly complicated buildings like pyramids and enormous ziggurats and temples and gargantuan stone circles and so on, with rocks weighing tens of tons, we look back on our ancestors as having very simplistic technology and we think to ourselves, how the hell could they have managed that? Surely some terribly clever lot flew in from some planet and help them create this thing, which may be doing our ancestors a considerable disservice and underestimating their ingenuity.
Exactly. No, I agree with you. I don't think humanity gives itself enough credit for what it would be capable of. I mean, the same with the traveling. Like we sort of feel like people went from, now I'm soapboxing. I sort of feel like people went from, you know, caves to now. That there was not other stuff going on. But you have studied the civilization. And can you see how people might have built those things on their own?
Oh, it's a phenomenal technical challenge, but they managed. I'm not precluding that no strange entity, whether it's from another planet or another dimension or wherever, might have arrived on Earth at some point and possibly still be wandering around Earth, even as we speak. I just don't think that it necessarily acts as the only explanation for technological development and advancement. That we've got to allow human ingenuity to be far more resourceful than it is. And some of it, I think, is also a bit of a spillover. Richard Dawkins, the biologist, I don't know how familiar he is to North American audiences, but he's quite a prominent voice in Britain in the New Atheist movement, this kind of quite hardline atheist movement that's very opposed to religion of any description. I've totally lost track of where I'm going.
No, but you were talking about how what was the term that you used? That we don't look into other aspects of perhaps from another dimension or
One of the explanations I've heard him offer in the past in the lectures and things is that mythology, stories of the thunder gods and the lightning gods and things like this, is a way for the scientifically naive to explain natural phenomena. So he kind of has this slightly...
So it's a rehash of the idea that we use gods to now the aliens are the gods that built the pyramids, because we can't figure out how that was
absolutely
done.
I'm not saying there were no naive people in ancient times, because there's naive people in every period of history, but this is a period of history where we're seeing people making enormous scientific advances, building phenomenal structures, sailing considerable distances, navigating by the stars, developing surgical techniques, doing all manner of things. Are we supposed to believe that they're so dunderheaded that the only way they understand thunder is a big giant banging a hammer on a rock?
Right, right.
When they're capable of all these other things.
So it was, and we still have like Thor and things like that today, and we're enjoying them in their present. Is someone going to like look at this slice of history and say, oh, they all worshipped, you know, the Marvel universe or whatever? I mean, some people do, but it is the thing. Okay, Robin, we're running out of time again. I need you to tell us about your books, where we can get them, about your blog, because it has more stories and you can hear more about Robin. In the meantime, Robin Sims, if you're out there, we're still waiting to hear about whether you want what Terrarian race you're talking about. Okay. Otherwise, we're going to have to take that. So, Robin, tell us about your books.
Certainly, I've got Pantheon, A Dangerous Place. There's Old Gods, New Druids, which looks at the development of Druidry from a polytheist angle. There's a couple of poetry, both my own one, the Bard Song, which we looked at last time, and Moon.
I have a hard copy now. So look at that pretty cover, okay? This is like, it has everything. It has how to write poems, why you should write poems, fun poems that Robin has created. It's the whole deal.
Thank you. So there's a fair few out there, and I've contributed to quite a few anthologies. In terms of the blog, the blog is called Round the Hearn, which is a joke based around an old 1960s radio program called Round the Horn. But people can Google that or put it into other search engines, which are available, and go on there. I record stories, myths, some of them traditional myths, some of them are original stories I've just made up on the spot. I record poetry, philosophical rants and rambles, all sorts of things, really. It's a bit of an eclectic mess, but there's all sorts of things up there.
Which means it's wonderful, because that's what Robin does. He's English. Right? This is okay. We have had votes for Tom Baker and David Tennant. I believe that Robin was perhaps, if I'm reading this right, pulling her legs with the Tartarian question. But he says, thank you, Vicky and Robin. It was a very interesting listening. It was very interesting listening to Robin from my side as well. Robin, you just, there's just so much that you have to share. So I am definitely going to be checking out your blog and looking forward to, I know it's going to take a couple of years before a novel shows up, but I'm willing to wait. So I won't bother you. If whenever you want to come and talk, tell me. I will talk to you anytime. But I don't want to ask again, because I've pulled you out here twice in the last couple of months. And I will start to feel guilty. So and thank you so much.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Happy to come back whenever you like.
And take care. And yeah, then we'll talk soon, Rob. We'll talk soon. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Always lovely to talk with Robin. And for the rest of you, Mayor. Right. Sorry. I'm still thinking about our conversation. Okay, for the rest of you, may your coffee be hot. And your story sweet. Thanks for listening, everyone.